And so our first lesson for this morning gives us the culminating incident in the life of Joseph. We've probably all heard the story of Joseph from the time we were little children. So I hope you'll excuse me, though, if I take a few minutes just to review some of the key incidents in Joseph's life that led up to today's story. When we first meet Joseph in the scriptures, he was the 17-year-old son of his father Jacob, the great patriarch. Partly because Joseph was Jacob's youngest child, and partly because he at the time was the only child of Jacob's favorite wife, Rachel, Joseph held a special place in his father's heart. He spoiled his youngest son shamelessly, and he demonstrated to his other children that he preferred Joseph over them. One such demonstration was given in the famous incident of the coat of many colors, a coat which Jacob gave to his son Joseph, but which he did not give to any of his other children. Now, perhaps the brothers of Joseph might have been able to forgive their father's great preference for their brother had it not been for the fact that Joseph had a pathological inability to keep his mouth shut about it. How he loved to boast how he was his father's favorite. How he loved to boast of his superiority over his older 11 brothers. He especially loved to describe for his brothers some of the dreams that were given to him, he said, by God. Dreams which illustrated how superior he was to they. In one such dream, he describes how he and his 11 brothers were binding sheaves of grain in the field, when suddenly his sheaf stood upright and the other 11 bowed down before his sheaf. In another of his dreams, he described how the sun, the moon, and the 11 stars, clearly a reference to his parents and to his 11 brothers, all bowed down before his superior glory. One day, when the 11 brothers were off in a distant pasture tending the family's sheep, Jacob summoned Joseph to his side and gave him the order to go and see to his brothers, see how they were doing. Joseph quickly complied with Jacob's command. But when Joseph's brothers saw Joseph coming towards them, far away from their father's protecting hand, they planned with one another a way to get rid of, once and for all, this pestilential little brat. They seized Joseph and threw him into a deep pit, intending to leave him there to die. But at that point, there appeared on the scene a caravan of Bedouin traders who were on a journey towards Egypt to carry on trade. Judah, the oldest of the 11 brothers, persuaded the others to take Joseph out of the pit and to put him in the hands of these traders. Then they took the many-colored robe, smeared it with blood, and returned to Jacob, telling Jacob that Joseph had tragically been torn apart by wild animals. Meanwhile, the Bedouin caravan, with Jacob in hand, arrived at Egypt. And the Bedouins sought to sell Joseph as a slave to the highest bidder. The one who succeeded in purchasing Joseph was a certain Potiphar, who was the captain of Pharaoh's guard. Things went well for Joseph as a slave in Potiphar's house. His wisdom, his cleverness, led to much prosperity for Potiphar, and soon Potiphar had rewarded him by elevating to the position of being the chief of his household staff. everything would have been fine for Joseph had it not been that Potiphar's wife took a deep like for this handsome young Hebrew slave. When Joseph refused her advances, she reacted with the ferocity of a woman scorned and lied to Potiphar that Joseph had tried to assault her. Potiphar was filled with fury, stripped all Joseph's honors from him, and had him thrown into prison. While in prison, Joseph's uncanny ability to interpret dreams served him in good stead. He soon ingratiated himself to the other prisoners by interpreting their various dreams. One of those whose dreams he interpreted was later released from prison and became the chief cupbearer in Pharaoh's household. At that time, Pharaoh was deeply troubled by difficult dreams that were being given to him, dreams that deeply disturbed his sleep. But his sages were incapable, it seemed, of interpreting these dreams. So Pharaoh's cupbearer, the former prisoner, a fellow prisoner with Joseph, told Pharaoh about this Hebrew slave who was in prison and who had an uncanny ability to interpret dreams. Pharaoh thus commanded that Joseph be brought for him and described his dream to Joseph, who proceeded to interpret it. Joseph said that his dream had been given to him by God to forewarn Pharaoh of the years that lay ahead for Egypt and indeed for the rest of the Mediterranean world. Joseph said that his dreams were pointing to the fact that there would be 7 years of bountiful crops in the land of Egypt. And then, tragically, these 7 years of good crops would be followed by 7 years of crop failure. Pharaoh would be wise, therefore, Joseph said, to gather up much grain during the 7 bountiful years and to store it in granaries for those 7 years, lean years that lay ahead. Pharaoh was much impressed by Joseph's wisdom and had him released from prison and made him the overseer of his granaries. This effectively made Joseph the second most powerful person in Egypt, behind only Pharaoh himself in power. Pharaoh's dreams came to pass. There were indeed 7 bountiful years, years of good harvest, during which time Joseph had stored in the granaries of Egypt a plentiful supply of grain. And then there ensued the years of great hardship, of crop failure. Hardship that befell not just the land of Egypt, but befell the whole eastern Mediterranean world, including the land of Joseph's birth, the land where Jacob and Joseph's brothers were still living. Jacob, during this time of crop failure, having heard that there was a wise man in Egypt who had stored away grain during the years of plenty, sent some of his sons to Egypt to purchase some of this grain. And so that brings us close to the point of today's reading. For the sons now appeared in Egypt before the overseer of Pharaoh's granaries. And the overseer proved to be none other than their brother, Joseph, the one they had wronged so grievously many years before. Thinking that Joseph was dead, or at very best, the miserable slave of Bedouin traders, they failed to recognize this mighty potentate as their brother. But Joseph, for his part, did recognize his brothers. He gave them a series of tests before revealing himself. Tests designed to discover whether his brothers had discovered a deeper sense of brotherly love and compassion than they had shown towards him years before. And when at last his brothers passed those tests, Joseph revealed his identity to them. His brothers were deeply dismayed. for they thought that surely Joseph would now exact a bitter vengeance upon them for all the harm that they had done to him years before. But to their surprise, Joseph did not. Rather, he extended his arms to them, he embraced them, he expressed his love for them. And then he uttered words that I'd like us to give a little thought to this morning. The words he said was that all these events that occurred in my life have occurred according to the plan of God. He said to his brothers, it was by God's plan that I was sold into slavery, and it was by God's plan that I became the overseer of the granaries of Egypt. God did this in order to preserve Jacob and his household for future generations. So Joseph, in describing the incidents of his life as all being part of God's plan, describes for us a basic issue of Christian theology, and that's the belief in divine providence. Providence, which talks about the overarching plan of God. The late Ralph Chalmers, who is a theologian and once taught at Pine Hill Theological College, wrote these words about providence. The doctrine of divine providence is fundamentally the affirmation that God guides and overrules the total process of nature and history and the lives of individual men in order that his purpose may finally be achieved. Joseph then was talking about God's providence, that all the events in his life had been turned by God into a source of good for him and for his family. All this was part of God's plan, Joseph said. Today's passage of Scripture, though, contains three important truths about the issue of divine providence. The first truth it points to is that divine providence is something that we don't usually understand or know about as we're involved in the events themselves, but it becomes apparent to us only as we look back upon those events. It was only as Joseph looked back upon all the events in his life that he began to see in them the hand of God. While he was engaged in those events, it wasn't apparent that God was acting. Sang Chu Lee, a former moderator of the United Church, writes, "Sometimes looking back over one's past experiences, it is possible to discover reasons and explanations which may not have been apparent at the time. God's guiding hand is never so clear as it is in retrospect." And in a similar vein, the late Leslie D. Weatherhead, who is the famous preacher at London City Temple, wrote, "I believe intensely in the loving guidance of God, but it is usually only when I look back that I can see convincing evidence of it." God's providence is at work in the world. God's plan is there. But it's usually only as we look back upon it that we can see it clearly. That was Joseph's experience, and that's probably the experience of most of us. The second truth that's made about divine providence in our reading is that divine providence does not deny human beings their freedom to act as they will. When Joseph's brothers conspired to put him to death, they were not acting as God's puppets, but they were acting as free, responsible agents. And they were entirely culpable for the deeds that they were performing. But what divine providence says is that God can take these actions that human beings perform, sometimes sinful, sometimes good, and he can weave them into a means of accomplishing his purposes. That's what he had done in Joseph's life, Joseph believed. Perhaps the clearest expression of that was found in our second scripture lesson for this morning, taken from the Acts of the Apostles, which describe the central event of the gospel, the crucifixion of Jesus. Those who put Jesus to death were not acting as mere puppets of God. They were acting out of their own self-willed, sinful, evil ways. But then God was able to take their actions and was able to use them as a means of bringing about His great purposes of the salvation of the world through the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. So the second point about providence that is made in today's lesson is that providence does not deny human freedom, but it does say that God has power to take the actions that we perform, sometimes good, sometimes bad, and to weave them into a way of creating His great plan, His great purposes. And the final point that needs to be made about this today's story is that Joseph was capable of seeing God's hand in his life only because he had been willing to forgive his brothers. Had instead he nurtured only bitterness and hatred towards his brothers for the wrong that they had committed against him, he never would have seen God's hand in his life and God's hand in the present circumstances. Jesus taught in the Sermon on the Mount that if we're going to worship, bearing our offering, and remember that we have something against a brother or sister, we must first go and be reconciled with our brother and sister, and then only then return on our way to worship. For the problem is that if we fill our hearts so full of anger and vindictiveness, we will be unable to experience the God of love and forgiveness. And so we have this marvelous passage of Scripture which talks about providence. Providence which is seen usually only as we look back upon our lives. Providence which does not deny human freedom. And providence which can be seen, as indeed God can be seen, only when we show an eagerness to forgive others and an eagerness to give up the hatred and spirit of vindictiveness that sometimes pollutes our heart.